Our first writer is Lou Bendrick. She bears with pride the oxymoronic title of environmental humorist. She's a former columnist with the Aspen Times, High Country News, and Northern Sky News. Her work now appears in various and sundry greenish publications, such as Grist, Plenty, Orion Online, and Whole Life Times. She is currently working on a book for the Mountaineers Books, The Eat Where You Live Guide to Local and Sustainable Food. Lou's carbon footprint can be found in Massachusetts, where she lives with her darling husband, precious daughter, and handsome dog. She wrote that, obviously. Okay. She's our sole humorist and told me when I talked to her earlier this week that she felt a bit of pressure to be funny. I told her not to worry, that this is an environmental conference and she should feel free to recycle some of her old jokes. Speaking of old jokes, okay. This is my one chance to match Nancy, okay? So I'm going to take it. I heard this recently. This one was delivered with a bit of a New England accent. What do you call a blind buck? No idea. What do you call a blind buck without legs? Still no idea. See, it's not easy. It's not easy. I knew that. It's okay. Our second writer is Bernd Heinrich. He's professor of zoology at the University of Vermont and a wildlife biologist. His 15 books include the Natural History Classic and Natural Book Award nominee, Bumblebee Economics. He has a home aviary that inspires many of the drawings and photos in his articles in Scientific American and the Smithsonian. And he's also an accomplished long-distance runner. Berlin Klinkenborg comes from a family of Iowa farmers and is the author of the books Making Hay and The Last Fine Time. He is a member of the editorial board of the New York Times, and his most recent book is Timothy, or Notes of an Abject Reptile. Jack Leslie began his career as a Los Angeles Times war correspondent in Vietnam. Good place to start. And has moved on to do magazine work and narrative nonfiction. His most recent book is Deep Water, The Epic Struggle Over Dams, Displaced People, and the Environment. And his July 2000 cover story for Harper's, Running Dry, What Happens When the World No Longer Has Enough Fresh Water, was included in the collection of the best American science writing for that year. Bill McKibben, immediately to my left, frequently writes about global warming and alternative energy, and the risks of human genetic engineering. He's a visiting scholar at Middlebury College and a board member and contributor to Grist magazine. His latest book is The End of Nature. And in his spare time at this conference, he slugs it out with such lightweights as Walmart, DuPont, and Pepsi. So to get started, we'll let humorists go first. Lou?
See if I have to adjust this mic for a short person. So, you know, as a humorist, I never thought I'd be saying this, but James Kunstler is a hard act to follow. But wow, forget waiting in line for the next hybrid car. We're all going to be commuting by ox cart in the near future. Before I get to some techniques about humor writing, I thought I would mention that I think that at least in some part it is personality driven. And then if you are a humor writer, the signs will probably be there already. I got my start at a small, I was a reporter at a small Colorado newspaper, and this was back in the era of pica polls, and they really did not know what to do with me at this newspaper. I mean, I was trying to make school board stories funny. But because I was one of the mostly sober members of the news staff, they really couldn't fire me. So I was kind of herded into a column position, which turned out well for everyone. I sort of found my voice and enjoyed it, and the paper didn't have to pay for another columnist. So the environmental part of my writing became much later as I became more anxiety-driven and about the state of the environment. And by the way, anxiety is definitely the trait of a humor writer. So as I became personally more green, I started to write more about the environment. And the first technique that I use when I'm writing about, when I'm writing environmental humor, is I try to make a connection with the reader. And I want to make it clear that I'm never making light of scientific data, but I see humor as sort of the cheese that wraps around a pretty big jagged pill. And, you know, what could be more jagged than, say, you know, the end of our species? But what I'm trying to do is help the reader process this information. And to give you an example of how I think a story can connect with a reader, I got an assignment from Grist not so long ago. Grist is an online magazine. And Grist asked me to go out and interview a bunch of environmentalists and ask them to confess their eco-sins, you know, the things that they're doing wrong, like, you know, God forbid, not buying recycled toilet paper. And I have to mention this because Bill McKibben was kind enough to talk to me for this piece, and I'll bet you're all kind of curious about what Bill's eco-sin could possibly be. Bill McKibben has several really large SUVs, which he uses to tote around his jet skis. Snow machines. He doesn't really even cross-country ski. Bill's environmental sin, if you could call it that, and I think, am I correct, it was too many pairs of cross-country skis. And I think maybe some of these skis had some, you know, nasty wax compounds on them, but it was still pretty light in terms of sin. But I think that this piece did a good job at connecting the average reader to an environmentalist who might be perceived as holier than thou. And I think Grist does a good job at reaching beyond the environmental choir. And that's important to me. I often ask myself when I write a piece, is my work accessible to a mainstream audience? And I think Grist does a good job at this. Another technique that I use is self-deprecation. And I think one of the reasons that Ann Coulter fails, okay, there are many reasons why Ann Coulter fails. One of them is that she's an evil succubus. but she, Ann Coulter is never going to, I think, really put herself out there for the sake of the reader. And she's never going to strap herself to a canon like some of my favorite humorists, like David Sedaris and David Foster Wallace and Dave Barry, which makes me think that I need to be named David to be a successful humor writer. You know, another David, David Remnick, in his introduction to a great humor anthology, Fierce Pajamas, which is the New Yorker's anthology, he had said that James Thurber, another great, was a belligerent soul, but that his favorite quarry was himself, and I always try to bear that in mind. And do you want a quick tip for an easy Halloween costume? Anyone out there? Okay, Ann Coulter makes an easy Halloween costume. You just get a blonde wig and a short skirt and call everyone a moron. You're, you know, trick or treat, you godless little pagans. And I think, so that's the free tip from the humorist today. Now, speaking of Ann Coulter, even though I think she fails on many levels, I think that this is a very wobbly podium here. I think that confrontation and outrageousness has its place, especially in humor writing, and I think it's an important part of political discourse. I think this is largely being fulfilled right now by television comedians. I personally am not seeing that much of it in print. I think people like Jon Stewart, love him or hate him, I think he's doing a good job at this. I don't know if any of you saw the episode of Crossfire that got Crossfire canceled. And let's see, some nodding heads here. Tucker Carlson, you know, the real journalist, went after Stewart for not asking hard enough hitting questions. And, you know, Stewart was just astonished at his own influence. You know, his retort was, you know, you guys are on CNN. The show that leads into mine is puppets making crank calls. You know? And, I mean, after that, what could poor Tucker say? I mean, now he's on Dancing with the Stars. And so I do think, my point is that I do think that confrontation is a good thing. I did a piece last year, again, for Grist, that it was called Queer Eye on the Green Guy. And I actually went after environmentalists and told them that if they wanted to be more successful, they should think strategically in terms of sartorial matters and lose the sandals and socks. Is anyone here wearing sandals and socks? Anyone? Oh, that's good, because I don't want anyone giving me the stink eye. You know, it's hard enough being up here without someone in sandals and socks. So another reason why I think that confrontation is a good thing, oh, I hope that's not my phone, is that I think that this current administration cannot be mocked enough. I'm not doing it enough, but yes, this administration and their environmental policy needs to be mocked more. Okay, so I think that the way environmental humor works is that I reach readers on a different level than straight-ahead journalism does. What I hope to offer is catharsis and connection and perhaps solidarity and anxiety and even facts. Yes, I do report my columns. I think sometimes people think that humorists never get out of their bathrobes, but I do. And, you know, Calvin Trillin once said that, you know, the jokes are sometimes suspended for the lamentable task of transferring a little information to the reader. And I definitely agree with that. And I also think that straight-ahead journalism and humor can coexist very meaningfully. And when I get insecure about this, I try to remember that Harold Ross, the first editor of The New Yorker, referred to his publication as his comic weekly. So, in closing, if it sounds like I am advocating for more humor here, I definitely am. I often joke that I am the sole and founding member of the International Society for Environmental Humor, and that I'm always looking for new members. So, thank you.
Next, Bernd Heinrich. He's gathering his books. A few remarks.
Well, I didn't come prepared for a speech. I thought, you know, a writer is somebody who writes, doesn't know how to talk, and that's, you know, I don't. That's why I write. Also, there was something about, you know, giving tips about writing or... Oh, a little bit closer? Okay. So I wasn't exactly sure what the mission was here, what my mission is supposed to be. But anyway, there was something about, you know, giving clues as to how each of us writes, and I'm sure everyone has different methods. And I was trying to think if I had a method, and I really, you know, had to scratch pretty deep, and I can't really think of anything. So I think I'm rather haphazard. The one thing that I think is, for me at least, very important is first of all, to come up with something where I think I have maybe a unique insight and also a passion. And then maybe the next step is to actually get that insight and get that knowledge, and that usually fuels the passion a little bit more, and then just go at it. So it's kind of, for me, kind of brute force and keeping something going that I'm really interested in and really wanting to get it to get it written down and to see what it develops, because a lot of times it just develops a lot differently than what I had planned. And I like to the idea of preserving it, having unique insights or information that I feel others don't have, and trying to learn at the same time and sharing it. So anyway, I started out writing more or less exclusively scientific papers, and maybe one of the things that I try to do is to write more broadly. I know I couldn't really make this science that funny. I thought at least I could make it more interesting. So I thought I would, you know, read a little bit from a couple of books and give you some ideas. So anyway, the first book that I wrote was Bumblebee Economics, and I was working in the lab and in the field doing all kinds of stuff with bees, probing them with thermocouples to get their rectal temperatures, remember they had a trivia contest at Stanford. They said the most trivial thing in the world was the rectal temperature of the bumblebee, but I thought it was very interesting, and especially when you connect it with everything else and what you could deduce from the rectal temperature of the bumblebee. But anyway, before the rectum of the bumblebee gets hot, it has to have a high thoracic temperature. And so I thought I would just give you just a sample of what I wrote here, my first book on temperature regulation in bumblebees and how they warm up. And this is about warming up before flight. The rapid low amplitude wing vibrations of a moth or a butterfly getting ready to take off leaves no doubt that the animal is contracting its muscles, as vertebrate animals do when they shiver. Bees have similarly been reported to buzz while warming up. Stingless bees, for example, hum during warm-up, and the frequency of the hum increases directly with the increasing thoracic temperature. Thus, one can determine the body temperature of a stingless bee by listening to the sound it makes. However, bumblebees warm up and keep warm while making no sounds whatsoever and while keeping their wings perfectly motionless, so the heat is produced by the wing muscles. The only externally visible indications of warm up is abdominal pumping. That's where the bumblebee's rectum is, used to ventilate the rapidly respiring thoracic muscles. The abdominal pumping movements tell us a lot about what is occurring inside the bumblebee. First, the duration, amplitude, and frequency of the pumping movements indicate the rate of gas exchange for respiration, which is correlated with the rate of energy expenditure. Second, the frequency of the pumping movement itself gives a fairly accurate indication of thoracic temperature. All one needs to determine the thoracic temperature is a sharp pair of eyes and a stopwatch. At a frequency of 1.1 pumping movements per second, Bombus edwardsii, Queens, had a thoracic temperature of 10 degrees centigrade. And at a frequency of 2.2 and 4.4, respectively, the temperatures are 20 degrees and 30 degrees. Now, the rate of pumping remains the same for a given temperature, regardless of whether the bees are actively warming up, cooling down, or maintaining a stable elevated thoracic temperature. However, while passively cooling or shivering slightly, bees only pump shallowly in occasional short bursts or not at all. And while shivering vigorously and maintaining a thoracic temperature much higher than the air temperature, they pump deeply and continuously. Obviously, high metabolic rates are correlated with abdominal pumping and stationary bees, but this tells us little about the mechanisms of heat production. Anyway, so when we actually get down what actually happens inside, how they move the muscles and all like that, so that is, again, another chapter. But I'll skip now way ahead to ecology and evolution, because the body temperatures told us a lot about the energy expenditure, and the energy expenditure varied depending on what food rewards they were going to, what flowers they would visit, and at what temperatures they could go. And that the rewards they get from the flowers in turn drive evolution for with regard to pollination. So the flowers are, in a sense, manipulating the bees. Okay, ecology and coevolution. In both physiology and ecology, the primary aim is to understand the interrelationships of component parts. What differs is the whole one takes as a point of reference, the organism or the ecosystem. An organism is more than a collection of cells. It is an integrated system. One studies the functioning of an organism system by observing the parts, making models of how they interrelate, and then testing the models by experiments that involve changing the system to observe predicted effects. Similarly, an ecosystem like a forest is more than a collection of trees. By determining the components of the system and arriving at logical constructs of how they interact with each other and with the environment, one produces models or hypotheses. In ecological systems, we are often restricted to observing the results of experiments that nature has provided, and nature confounds all the variables and seldom provides controls. Furthermore, the time course is different. Removing the heart of a bumblebee would prevent it from flying because the flight muscles could no longer be supplied with sufficient amounts of fuel, and because it might overheat. But removing a vital component from a forest may not yield visible results until decades later. It all adds up to challenging science. In ecological systems, it is seldom possible to remove or ablate a component, such as the pollinators. Hence, the approach tends to be descriptive and analytical rather than experimental. But change in one part of the system must eventually bring change to another, for the parts have not been assembled at random through evolution. One can ask then not only how the system functions at any one time, but also how the system came into being. Okay, so this was back in 79, I believe, and recently I wrote The Geese of Beaver Bog, which concerns geese that I watched right just a couple of miles down the road at a beaver bog close to a house in Hinesburg. And so I read from the introduction. There's something in the ceaseless chatter of migrating geese that stirs me. Perhaps it touches something wild, remote, and mysterious that I share with them, for it is almost with longing that I look up every fall and spring when the scraggly V formations wing their way overhead high in the sky, which is right about now. Perhaps it is the tenor of their haunting cries, their mastery of sky and distance, their commitment and single-mindedness in striving to reach far-off goals that enchant. Whatever it might be, the migrating geese are a phenomenon of nature, even though to the naked eye they are barely visible patterns of dark specks against the endless skies. For many years, the geese seemed physically remote to me. That changed dramatically after my family and I got to know one individual Canada goose. We called her Peep. Peep was not a phenomenon, and I can't say she inspired. She became too close and personal for that. Yet she always retained a connection to the wild, and I hope she still is living the life that wild geese live. Peep stayed with us for a while one summer, a few years ago, and through her I was introduced to other Canada geese who nested in a nearby beaver bog. Her inadvertent gift to me was that, though through her I came to know other geese and other swamp denizens, especially the common grackles and the red-winged blackbirds who were a study in contrasts. So, yeah, she left that fall and I presume she had an accident by hitting a truck or something, or a car, because she would follow anybody in a car. And a noisy car would apparently represent to her a flock, since she didn't know real flocks. So a flock to her was something noisy, and she'd follow. So she would fly alongside, and I thought she'd be gone. But a couple of years later, she came back again and brought a gander with her. And that's kind of where the story started. Okay, how much more time do I have? Okay, so just very short then. right now I'm working on the Snoring Bird, the book, My Family's Journey Through a Century of Biology. And maybe I'll just read a little of the introduction. Well, actually, this is not the introduction. I see this is chapter one. So anyway, the thing is, I'm getting more and more personal and injecting feelings into it and trying to make the science more interesting, and it's becoming more personal. So anyway, so it starts out, Mamusha is just settling down on her bed to watch the evening news when I arrive. Two cans of Coors, which he has opened with the point of a pair of the scissors, are on the table next door, along with a box of German chocolates. She used to make her own beer, but now, in her mid-80s, it's Coors from a can, and because her gnarled hands are too weak, she cannot pull off the tabs. Duke, a huge shepherd hound that she has rescued from the pound, is at her feet, and a one-legged chicken lies cradled in her lap. She is mildly irritated at me for arriving unannounced, but soon I have placated her, and she offers me a beer. Mamusia is a Polish word for mama or mommy. She was born and raised in what is now Poland, and despite her willingness to consume Coors, she remains in her memories and her ways a product of the old world. My visits to her are usually spent listening to stories about the past. We are sitting in the low ceiling brick room that Papa built earlier for the purpose of protecting his precious wasp collection from fire. The rest of the house might be consumed, but his ignomens would be safe. When we moved into this house in 1951, it was a simple salt box style farmhouse with six rooms. And since Papa's death, Mamusha has added on haphazardly so that the house is now a collage of 13 rooms. The walls are decorated with pictures of flowers that she has purchased, although one wall sports a portrait of George and Laura Bush that she has received free in the mail. This small brick room is her main habitation, which she shares with her house chickens. I was met in the entryway by three hands perched on the dresser. In the living room, one drawer is partly open to accommodate a setting hen that has made her nest there. My chickens outsmarted me again, Mamusha says. Yesterday I found one upstairs in the corner of the bedroom. I have too many. Next time bring your shotgun and at least help me to get rid of the few roosters. Anyways, I think I'm running out of time here. So.
Like science writing that uses beer as an entree. Our next author is Verlin Klinkenborg.
Thank you. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here. I want to talk very briskly and without much fuss about a little bit of my writing life and how I think about it, how it breaks down. There are several categories. I write editorials for the New York Times. A lot of people assume that I just write the rural life and that's somehow a paying wage, which is wonderful. I wish it were true. I write about 120 editorials a year. About 27, 30 of those are signed on issues that range from life on our small farm to almost anything else I'm interested in. Most of the rest of them are about public lands. They're about Richard Pombo. They're about James Inhofe. They're about the real bad guys out there in one form or another. And then there's the writing life that I have in my books, which is completely separate from my journalism, which I think of, and if this sounds arrogant, I apologize, I think of as my commitment to an education in literature and to the making of literature. I also spent the last 25 years teaching creative writing, nonfiction always, to college students all across the country. And what I find, let me put this the right way if I can. Journalism is a wonderful thing. I'm an accidental journalist. I was trained as an academic. The pursuit of fact is incredibly important. But for the character of the story that you all have to tell to reach readers, it has to come in the form of truth, which means it needs to take the imaginative form of literature. It needs to reach them on a deeper level than journalism often does. It's not that the two are incompatible, the two are deeply compatible, but I think that in my experience, teaching writers, especially journalists, I taught for a long time at Harvard where I had many Nieman Fellows as part of my nonfiction curriculum. I spent 14 weeks with these students, most of them mid-career journalists, and at the end of 14 weeks, we could barely see beyond the edges of the boxes in which they had been trained to write. My impression all along has been that journalism tends to be a very narrowing, a very constricting exercise for a writer. It's why when I talk to my young students, I'm committed to teaching them to make art, to think about the full resources of the language, to draw as richly as they can upon not merely environmental journalism, but any form of literature they can find themselves immersed in. After all, go back 50 years or so, there were no MFA programs, hardly any journalism programs, certainly no programs in environmental journalism, and yet somehow writers got made. They got made out of reading, and they got made out of writing. It's as simple as that. What I find always works with my young students, and it works, again, with more experienced students who are trying to break out of what they've been taught, if you take them back to fundamental assumptions about how sentences operate, and about avoiding the expectations that you feel surrounded by as a writer, the shape of the story, pitching the story, the nature of the audience, all of that nonsense that you've been carrying around with you all these years, and go back to thinking about sentences as if they were individual moments in a poem, something happens. Your imagination begins to change. The character of your expressive power begins to change. The reach of your emotions expands dramatically, and suddenly you find yourself no longer quite so worried about, well, gee, this is an 800-word piece that's running as a sidebar in an environmental magazine that has this demographic for its audience. And what you're really trying to figure out is, how do I actually make this story live on the page? Now, one of the ways to do that is to, I'm going to talk as if we're just a room full of my students here because it's the only way I can stay comfortable up here and not be intimidated by you all. One of the most important things to do is go back to the assumptions that you carry around with you as writers that you may not have ever examined very closely. I find it very hard to teach students to actually pick up each assumption they have about how writing works and interrogate it, question it seriously. The fun part about teaching young students is they come in so loaded with what the culture has given them as writers, false assumptions about writing, that it's easy to pick them out. It's easy to find out what the problems are and teach them to throw those things away and begin re-examining what they know about writing. It's much harder when you have as much experience as you do because much of what you've done has worked. Much of what you've done has been successful. But I always feel, for every writer, the real goal is constant and eternal transformation. So what has worked is not necessarily a measure of where you are as a writer. Where you are going next should be a measure of where you are as a writer. Let me give you an example of some of the problems that I find all the time. I find writers consumed by, well, craft is one thing. I never talk about craft. I don't believe in the word. To me, craft means toothpick sculptures and little table centerpieces, the kind of things my mother-in-law used to make year-round. I find writers consumed by ritual and fetish and fear. And what I mean by that is everybody always wants to ask me, so how do you write? I mean, what's your routine? What routine would that be? When would I have time to have a routine? I love the assumption that I'll write every morning. I'll go out to my my little whitewashed cabin in the woods, where I have a typewriter, a wastebasket, and a shotgun. And I'll just really commit myself to the project. But I don't know about your lives, but my life is way too crowded for any anxiety about, am I meeting my daily quota? Am I spending my hour and a half in my room? I write every instant of the day because I write with my head. In other words, I don't make a fetish out of my tools. I don't care whether I use a piece of paper, my computer, whether I use a napkin, whether I just actually work out the paragraphs in my head in the middle of the night when I wake up and then remember them, which is not that hard. All you have to do that is start memorizing a lot of poetry. Suddenly you'll find, well, not only do I know a lot of wonderful poetry, but my memory has really expanded. That desire to make a fetish out of the act of writing, the tools of writing, it gets in everyone's way, and I'll tell you how it works. If you have to have a favorite pen, or a favorite place, or a favorite word processing program, or a favorite kind of paper to write on, every item you set in front of you as a writer that makes it easier for you to write becomes a prohibition when you don't have it. So my job as a writer is to acquire nothing. As a writer, nothing. In other words, if I'm driving 2 hours, 4 hours to give a talk like this, and I find myself working on thoughts, working on structural elements, composing paragraphs, I know that this is my livelihood, I will remember those things. Now, the other thing I was talking about was fear. Fear is unbelievably important in the life of a writer. And it's a fear that I find fascinating. All of my young students are desperately terrified of using up their material. You may remember this one from when you were a young writer. You write that unbelievably perfect first paragraph, just unbelievably good, and then there was nothing to follow. Or it's like a shell game. I get these pieces where someone has only really one thing to say, and you can feel the entire piece being an effort to delay the saying of that one thing so the piece is long enough. That is exactly how an incredible amount of journalism works. Well, my feeling is, squander your material. Use it all up. Use it now. Use it in this piece. First of all, there will be more coming from your imagination. There's an infinity of research to be done out there. There's a world to be investigated. And the more you can commit yourself to an insurrection, first of all, against your own fear as a writer, but second of all, against the limitations that are forced upon you as environmental journalists by the organizations you work for, by the assumptions that govern those organizations, the better off you will be. Because the other thing that I find students fearful about and worried about is this fundamental thing. I mean, whenever I give a talk or a meeting, somebody in the audience, very kind, will say, you have such a gift, it's been a pleasure listening to you. Your writing shows us that you have a gift. And I love that metaphor, the gift. It implies there's just this little box inside me and I just open it and out comes all this stuff. I've tried to think a lot about how I differ from other writers, and the only way that I'm sure that I differ from the ones that I know is that I know exactly what I'm interested in. I've learned to pay enough attention to myself, to my emotions, to the little vibrations that go on inside me to be able to tell when something resonates with me. That is something that my students are desperately afraid of. They feel like they don't know it. I think there are probably many people in this room who feel like they may not be sure about it. That ability to be committed to what you're interested in without regard to the form it takes, the expectations that surround it, addressing what you're interested in a language that keeps language alive. I mean, think about this task. Your job is not only to save the world, it's to save the language, too. If that's not part of your task, then it seems to me we're giving over one of our essential tools to a kind of gradual erosion. I could go on and on, but I won't. What I want to say is that all of these things boil down to nothing more than thinking and reading and writing, paying attention as closely as you can to what your own instincts are and using them, and always committing yourself to work against the internal assumptions of the organization that employs you. If that sounds ironic coming from a member of the New York Times editorial board, that gives you an idea of the complexity of my job. Thanks.
Doc Leslie.
Well, first I want to say that it's an absolute honor to be a part of this panel. I think in many ways my experience enables me to say that I embody what Berlin has just been talking about. And what I have to offer in part is a cautionary tale. As was mentioned, I began as a war correspondent in Vietnam. And in many ways, that experience spoiled me. I had a very intense time. In the course of 2 years, I was wounded once. I went from crisis to crisis, and I was finally kicked out of the country. I went on and covered the war in Cambodia, went back to Cambodia near the end, and left in an American evacuation helicopter. And when all this was done, I felt intensely depressed, and I realized that even though after that, I covered many other crises, mostly in Asia. Everything felt anticlimactic. There was nothing that would have that same sense of resonance that Vietnam had had for me, in which I felt that I was in the cockpit of the world. I was covering the most important story in the world, and what could possibly touch that afterwards? And at the same time, there was a part of me that chafed as a newspaper reporter. I would get into arguments with editors over grammar and usage. And to them, I think I was considered a great annoyance, but I felt that these were really important issues. And finally, I quit and decided that I wanted to write more deeply than I could for a newspaper, and began a process that was much longer and more difficult than I had imagined when I did that, although I certainly have no regrets whatsoever that I did. But what I had to do was to break all the rules that I'd learned as a journalist, to break out of that safe, conventional, but pallid voice of standard journalism. And it was only when I began to do that that I began to feel that I was expressing my own voice, that there was a voice there that I could tap, and that that was something important to do. I also felt for many years that the environmental story was the great underreported story of our times, and it still is. It is the most important story. And I would propose story after story to editors, and almost invariably they were turned down until finally, just I think out of sheer persistence, I was able to do a long piece for Harper's with a wonderful editor who was then there, Colin Harrison. About global water scarcity. And I spent a long time doing this piece. I think it took about 6 months to do. But as I did it, I felt there is so much here. There is so much that people don't understand. I'm just at the beginning of this subject and knew that I wanted to write a book about this. I'd done a book about being a correspondent in Vietnam, but this felt different. I had by this time also decided that I wanted to write narrative nonfiction. When I was in college, I deeply admired the works of people like John McPhee and Gay Talese and Joan Didion, with a little dollop of Norman Mailer and a large dollop of George Orwell. And I thought at some point, well, I would like to write like them. But I wasn't giving myself that chance. And so I reached a point in my life where I realized if I didn't start doing it, if I didn't stop waiting to be asked to do it, I was going to lose the chance. And so I announced to the editors that I worked with that from now on I was only going to write narrative nonfiction. And to my amazement, they immediately began giving me those stories to do, and I've been writing it ever since. I love it because it pulls readers in. It enables me to use my voice to the fullest. There is an element of surprise, because in this kind of writing, I go out with the people I'm writing about, and I never know what's going to happen. And so there's a constant sense of unexpected and a freshness that gets into the piece. After I did this piece on water, I had discovered that at the center of story after story about conflict over water were dams. Dams, indeed, are magnets for conflict. And so I felt that to do a book, I should write about dams. It happened then that there was a commission called the World Commission on Dams, which was then convening over a two-year period. And its 12 commissioners had been picked in a very interesting way. There were four who were considered anti-dam, four who were considered in the middle, and four who were pro-dam. And so I decided that I would pick the most interesting person in each of those three groups, and they would be the three sections of my book. So I wrote one section about the world's foremost anti-dam activist, a woman named Medha Patkar in India, who has, in protest against a horrific dam project in India that consists of 30 large dams, 135 medium-sized dams, and 3,000 small dams, has gone on hunger strikes of 17, 22, and 26 days. She has tried repeatedly to drown herself in rising reservoir waters as this dam was being built, and on one occasion would have died except that the police, at the last moment, as the water was reaching her here, pulled her away because they wanted to save the government the embarrassment of her death and all the attention that that would focus on this project. And I wrote about an anthropologist named Ted Scudder, who was considered the world's leading authority on dam resettlement and had done the bulk of his work in southern Africa. So we went together to a number of projects where he had worked in southern Africa. Another remarkable story, because this was a man who in 1956 had done his first major anthropological study on a group of people called the Tonga, who lived around the Zambezi River and who were about to be moved as a dam called Kuriba was built. And so this was a kind of benchmark study to take down what these people were like before their lives were entirely altered. And there were 57,000 of them who were moved. And when he began doing this as a young man, he had no doubt that the dam was a good idea and assumed that all dams, well, maybe not all dams, but dams in general were a good idea. And then he watched what happened to these people after they were moved. And he went to see them every 2 years and up until a few years ago. And what he ended up doing was tracing the decline and shattering of this culture, which had been vibrant. And still he clung to the idea that there was such a thing as a good dam. And so this part of the book is called One Good Dam, because even now he will say that he believes in this idea, and yet his career in many ways has consisted of finding some project that he thought had great promise, becoming involved in it, studying it, and becoming disillusioned. So that was the second part. And the third part of the book is about the manager of a commission that oversees the only major river system in Australia, the Murray Darling, which, because of dams and other water diversions, now has a little over a quarter of the flow it had before there were white settlers and dams and all these diversions. This is a man who believes in dams more than the other two. He was drawn from the pro-dam category. And yet, what he spent his 14-year tenure in this job doing was trying to persuade farmers and politicians that they had to return some of the water that they'd taken back to the river, or the whole river would die. And he did persuade them, and there was finally an agreement in which they agreed to return a very small portion of the water, but it was a first step. And yet, as seems so typical with so many environmental victories, although the agreement was made, Australia has been experiencing a terrible and indeed unprecedented drought over the last 6 years, and the water has yet to be returned. Now there's an extraordinary lagoon at the mouth of the river, which is now almost empty of fish as a result because it's not getting the fresh water that it needs. There is another extraordinary place where river red gums, the emblematic eucalyptus tree of Australia, are by the hundreds of thousands dying along the river. And to see these trees is like looking at an arboreal charnel house. And so I wrote about his efforts to persuade people to give back water. Each of these trips that I took went with a large element of the unknown. When I went to see Maida, the Indian woman, at a time when she was preparing to make another attempt to drown herself. And she thought that each time she thought that she was going to do this and that her death would provoke an intense fury, and that made her certain that it was the right thing to do. And so as I went to see her, I had a remarkable experience. Each facet of this trip unfolded as if it had been preordained, and I knew exactly where in the book this event ought to go. It just fell right into place, and I began to think, well, maybe it will always be like that. It's not. With Africa, it was much more difficult because we went to several different projects and I had to figure out a way to piece those together. With Australia, I was still dealing with a bureaucrat, and I love the challenge of trying to make a bureaucrat's life become something that people ought to read about. And yet, after going on the first trip with him, there wasn't enough. There was something missing. And so I went back and I went from one place to another along the river so that I could make the river a major character in this part of the piece. There would always be a way, but you had to be open and flexible to what was there. My notion in doing all this was that what gave me a kind of confidence to go on, and what I took so much pleasure in, was finally throwing off all the notions of newspaper journalism, trusting in my own writer's voice, allowing myself to write lyrically, to use unobvious words and complicated constructions, if that seemed to be called for, to employ shading and nuance, to invest every sentence with energy and power. And that, I think, is a goal that every writer ought to have. Or otherwise, what are those words for? What are those sentences for? I want to make sure I haven't left out anything I meant to say here. I heard Tom Waits say on the radio some time ago that he likes to sing beautiful melodies that tell terrible stories. And I realized when I heard that applies to the kind of writing I like to do. Those are the stories that appeal most to me. And maybe some of that will rub off on you as well. I've tried to instill this book, and indeed all my writing, with beauty and elegance, not only because I find this satisfying on a personal level, but also as a kind of palliative to seduce readers into taking on, ideally even looking forward to reading, the stories of suffering and destruction that the book contains. My intention now is to keep writing in this way about the environment, the most important subject in the world, for as long as I can. And I'd like to finish by just reading you from the very end of Deep Water, from the epilogue about dams. We erect dams assuming that they are eternal, as if they'll never topple over or be dismantled or filled with sediment or lose their financial rationale. Yet all dams will die. All that remains unknown is the manner of their passing, whether they will be drained and safely put out of operation, decommissioned in the lingo, or will, out of indifference or misjudgment or an act of war, collapse to the enormous peril of all beings downstream. Dams are, of course, loaded weapons aimed down rivers, pointed at ourselves. They're proof of the gambling nature of the societies that build them. Imagine these dams in 500 or 1,000 years after their useful life has ended, when an earthquake from the fault line beneath Sardar Sarovar fractures it, or the bankruptcy of Zambia and Zimbabwe leads to Kariba's fatal neglect, or the bankruptcy or Three Gorges fills with sediment, or Katse gets too expensive to maintain, and when every one of them suffers from an altered hydrological regime as a result of climate change. Take your pick of mortal scenario. Cumulatively, they're more plausible than the assumption that mega dams will be successfully financed, adroitly managed, and properly maintained into perpetuity. Some dams will crumble into the basins from which they rose, while others may still be intact, but no longer storing water, which instead runs over or through or around them. There'll be relics of the 20th century, like Stalinism and gasoline-powered cars, symbols of the allure of technology and its transience, of the top-down, growth-at-all-costs era of development and international banks, of the delusion that humans are exempt from nature's dominion, of greed and indifference to suffering. If there are tourists, then, they'll circulate through the ruins as they as they now inspect the pyramids, awed by the structure's technological prowess and unimaginable cost. The people who lived around the dams will have been dispersed, of course, and their culture shattered, and the rivers in their valleys may still be depleted. But the dams' ephemerality, not the rivers, will then be on display. They'll be reminders of an ancient time when humans believed they could vanquish nature and found themselves vanquished instead. Thank you.
That was great, and those were all great. I've had the privilege of reading the most recent books by everybody on this panel. They're just fantastic, and to getting to see Lou's work in Grist all the time. If for some reason there's anybody in this room who doesn't have Grist bookmarked on their browser or whatever, do it the first thing you get back. It's probably the most important new development in environmental journalism in the last decade, and a real gift to us all. I am here under sort of false pretenses. I have very little to tell you about how to write anything. I've never taken a writing course nor taught one, and I don't think that much really about it. Only as Kathy Moore said earlier today, and sort of in retrospect, looking back at things I've written, do I have some sense of what I was about. And one of the things I've noticed is that I tend to alternate big, difficult, emotionally difficult, difficult to report books like The End of Nature and things like that, with more personal or books that allow a different part of me to come out. And I'm going to just read for you just for a minute from one of those, because it's about Vermont and the Adirondacks, and I'd like it to kind of serve as a sort of benediction to your time here. We've been very happy to have you here in Vermont. You may have noticed how pleased everyone was the governor came, all of that. Basically, that's because it's extremely difficult to get people to come to Vermont once the leaves are down and things. They optimistically refer to this as the shoulder season, you know, here, but we're very grateful for your presence here. I want to follow up on what Jim was saying earlier this morning, because I think, and it's sort of what I was trying fumblingly to get at the other day when I was talking with the guys from Coke and Walmart and things, I think that the essential thing that we need to understand is that the world really is going to be changing pretty abruptly for the reasons that Jim outlined about energy, and probably for the even more pressing reason that we're running smack into climate change now in a way that even a few years ago, even those of us very worried about it, didn't understand both the scale and the rapidity with which this wave was breaking above our heads. I think the world is going to change, and the only thing I want to say at the end is I don't think all the changes are going to be for the worse. The book that I'm writing now, finishing at the moment, that'll be out this winter, is a book largely about sort of local economics and what they might look like and things. And one of the conclusions of them is that the world that we've constructed so far, the one we spend all our time informing each other about, one of the most interesting properties of it is that it hasn't made us as happy as it claims to have. And that's that sort of set of facts, and they're an emerging body of data from economics and psychology and elsewhere to indicate that Americans are by no means the happiest people on earth, not even close to it. That at least gives us some place to look as we think about the future and about very large, not marginal, very large changes in how we live. This little book of mine is a book called Wandering Home, and it's about walking from where I live now in Vermont over to where I've spent most of my life in the Adirondack Mountains, where some of you are about to go and have a wonderful time. It's one of the great, it's the great wilderness of the East, and one of the most impressive, it's the greatest example of ecological recovery on Earth, and an amazing place to be. At any rate, as I was doing this walk, one of the things that I was really looking for more than anything else was kind of some sense of where a hope for the future might come from, what it might look like. And I was going from small farmers to people doing incredibly interesting work on how to get, you know, capture some of the value of the forest of this place for the people who live here, and on and on and on. I'm going to describe, just read a little bit about what happened one morning in August, a very hot morning, a very hot day, and I'd been visiting the home of a friend of mine, a guy named Chris Granstrom, just north of Middlebury, who in the last few years has developed one of Vermont's first vineyards, and we were there pruning his vines and things and taking cuttings. And it was one of those real humid days, and a thunderstorm, of course, eventually broke out around noon, so he had to retreat into his shed, and we were forced to drink a bottle of the wine that he made with his from his first vintage. And so finally in the afternoon, I wandered on along this sort of three-week backpack that I was going on. And I should say, this one of the things that was going through my mind all the way through this is how much I hate a certain kind of travel writing that's all about locating the perfect place someplace else where you aren't, like Tuscany or Provence or something, and positing that were we all to live there, things would be fantastic. So I ended up walking along Vermont's longest river, something called Otter Creek, and I was going north upstream towards Middlebury. The thunderstorm had done little to cut the late afternoon heat, and steam was rising off every puddle. But along the riverbank, giant hemlocks provided their own deep shade and a spring-loaded carpet of red needles to walk on. Peering out through the branches, I watched dragonflies float above the lazy river and listened to the rising tremolo pulse of insect song and felt my belly full of wine. Leave Provence to the Provençals and Tuscany to the Tuscans. The world was altogether sweet enough right here. Why, Provence could kiss my sweaty derriere, I thought, with just the slightly sodden pleasure of someone a trifle drunk. Drunk on that fine Riesling, but even more on the close, humid, singing torpor of an afternoon in the hemlock woods on the edge of Otter Creek, and even more on the sense that life, which in most places seems to me to be spinning apart, was somehow slowly gathering here, deepening, threatening to make sense. It's that making sense that we've got to figure out for our society. And our role as people who write about this, think about it, and serve as the kind of transmission point between people doing interesting new things and people stuck in old and no longer tenable patterns, is incredibly important work to find those embers and blow on them and allow people to realize that there are other very different possibilities for the world. It's very, very, very good work, and very important work, and thank you all for being about it.
Thank you very much. Please thank all of our authors here.